Welcome to Cloudlandia, Mr. Sullivan.
Welcome. So when we start, is one of us in Cloudlandia and one of us in the mainland? And
I think both. I think it's the connection that makes it Cloudlandia. I think when two or more are gathered in the cloud, that becomes Cloudlandia. Otherwise, we're just the mainland looking for a connection.
That's got a great definitional quality to it. Yeah. And just a little checking here, the seat that you're sitting in, very comfortable for you?
It's very comfortable. Yes.
Me too. I've got this very nice red leather chair. I'm in house number one. I have a gas fireplace playing to the left here.
Okay. All right.
I don't have the benefit of automatic sunshine, you know, where I live. Yeah, so you make up for it.
Well, I've had to come inside today because it is chilly today. It's, you know, 50 something degree. I almost had to wear socks today, Dan.
That's a mainland experience. That's definitely a mainland experience. And you know, so what's the proper blend of mainland and Cloudlandia? You know, how do you simultaneously reinforce both experiences such that a growth in one leads to a growth in the other?
That's a great question. That's worth pondering. I mean, I've been thinking now about all these things that are mainland centered, but Cloudlandia enhanced, you know, like being able to have a conversation. Like I miss our table 10 experiences where we would meet quarterly for breakfast, you know, that there's something to that, that this sort of it's a similar thing. We get to have the conversation, but it's a different, it adds another dimension to it to be in person. You know, there's something, there's some depth to that, which I enjoy and miss. But
maybe we have to jointly invest in two table 10 situations. Like I would have one in my basement, you would have one on your patio, and we would agree, you know, we would do it directionally, like, one of them is on the north side and one's on the south side, chairs. And both of us would be in our table 10 situation when we do our podcast. I don't think it's a replacement.
No.
But maybe the chairs will be the best we can do.
This is where I think, Dan, like I've often thought about I'm not a big fan of the way that the VR is going, where it requires putting the helmet on. You know, I'm very resistant to that. But what
can't see it as ever being normal. The problem is you can't see it ever.
That's the thing.
If something can't be normalized, then it's not really part of the future.
Right. What I would much prefer is I could see, Dan, a table 10 set up where I've got, you know, half of the table, and then there's a screen, a big immersive screen that, 4 feet by 4 feet screen in between us, which would be halfway between the table. And then you're sitting on your side, and I'm looking at this big monitor that's immersive. That'd be like and I think we could do that with Zoom. That's just a bigger monitor and stuff. That I think would be a great thing. And I would much rather have that. Like I've said before, I would be a big fan of like a holodeck, you know, if you say like a Star Trek term, where a room in our home is like all sides screen that now you're in you're in an alternate anywhere that you want to be. Mm-hmm. To me, I think it is great. The studio where I do my podcasts now, my video things, they have a giant AR wall that is like, you know, 12 by 20, that's all, you know, 8K LED. You could literally be anywhere, you know, it's something. Yeah.
Well, we're being guided by their design knowledge to build our new studio in Toronto. So
perfect. Yeah.
Yeah. And we're, you know, we have a basement in our Toronto office which, you know, was destroyed by the flood, feet of water.
You had a great podcast studio down there already. It was really.
Yeah, well, I did, and it was its previous existence was as a post-production studio for the movie industry in Toronto. So they had floating floors and, you know, the glass booth. But for podcast purposes, you don't really need that. I mean, it was overqualified. It was overqualified, and technology's taken a jump. That's a 25-year-old, you know, build-in. And technology's taken a huge jump. And so we're going to have a full video studio, two full audio studios, and then a meeting room lounge, you know. So I always feel you have to have a cafe if you're being a serious creative human. You have to have a cafe. And so we'll have a cafe meeting room with tables and everything like that.
I love
that. Yeah. So anyway, yeah, I'm looking at it. I was reading a couple articles this week. One was on Apple is trying to get into the augmented universe, and they've got it down to goggles, you know, like ski goggles. They think that, you know, and what they're finding is an absence of check writers who want to purchase the experience. And the same thing, Meta, you know, with, the Android previously known as Facebook is now gone through a name change to become Meta. And they're just not fine. The biggest problem they're having is they can't even get their employees to buy into it because they're supposed to start having their meetings in Meta. I mean, you'd think if you're going to sell it to your customer base, you'd want your employees, but the employees think it sucks. You know,
right?
And,
yeah.
And so, you know, we may hit an experiential wall here, you know, with technology, that we have a sense of what's comfortable experience. And when you ask us to give up, I mean, the universe I'm sitting in now is fully sensory. It's fully sensory. Mm-hmm. You know, I can look around here, and you're depriving a person of a lot of senses. Touch is one of them. Smell is another one.
Yeah.
And everything. I can't see how asking people to give up primary senses to experience something new is a move forward.
Yeah, I can't either. I saw a video on, the Consumer Electronics Show that was like highlighting the best of 2023. And they showed the VR, like all the VR things in the area, and everybody's got their helmets on and their, you know, the newest thing now, Dan, is these muffler things that you put over your mouth to muffle your screams and shouting and voice stuff. So you're not disturbing everybody in the house. It just makes you look so. I mean, just observing people in that world, in that full on, you know, you got your things and your haptic suit and your all the things that try and make VR as close to the real thing as possible, make you just so far from reality on observation from the mainland. Looking at people in this is so. It's so ridiculous. You've got to suit up, you know?
Yeah, which eats into productivity, you know? I mean, you know, the one thing you don't want to do is give people the sense of being less productive. And anytime you ask them to go through more motions and put out more effort and take up more time.
It's a conscious choice, right? Exactly.
But it doesn't produce any bigger result. You're trying to climb a waterfall. You know, I mean, you're trying to swim up a waterfall. And, you know, I've been thinking about it a lot because some interesting things have been happening over the last 2 or 3 months. One is the mass hirings of hundreds of thousands of tech workers in the main tech companies. And the other thing is that their valuations have dropped collectively. If you take the big five, Google and Apple and Facebook and, you know, Amazon and who else, Tesla. Mm-hmm. I think Tesla would be one of them, anything. And
just dropped their prices by 20%.
Yeah, well, they've dropped $3 trillion. You know, I mean, you know, they're starting to use trillion as a measurement now, and they've dropped $3 trillion. And there's a general, and then they're finding spooky stuff, you know, Elon Musk's revelations of every couple of days showing where some government official or some corporate official was planning and striving to do dodgy things on Twitter. And they're developing that they're starting to take on a creepy quality. And I was reading a review of a book that was written in the 1930s by an Italian philosopher. Get the hell out of here. Get the hell out of here. Yeah. I mean, she's a demotivator. I mean, she right off the bat, she's an artificial demotivator. Okay. And that's sort of the type of person you're glad you didn't marry, you know? And anyway, this philosopher, his name is Del Noce, D-E-L, one word, J-N-O-C-E, Augusto, I guess, August, Augusto Del Noce. And he's talking about the tendency that everything after a while, if you pursue technology down a line, it affects the kind of government you have to have. It affects the type of corporation you have to have. And they take on similar qualities. The corporations and the government take on similar kind of qualities. And he labels the resulting society that's more or less dominated by technology, government, corporate kind of integration with each other. He calls it techno-fascism.
Okay.
And I was thinking about it because there's been the big news stories of the last week. I've been finding all sorts of improper, top secret in many cases, but certainly classified documents in the various think tank centers and garages and houses of the current president of the United States.
Yes.
And the media, who are on his side, because the previous president, his palace in Palm Beach was raided.
And
they were finding boxes of documents and everything. But of course, that was bad. And the current president that was sort of sloppiness on his part, sort of sloppiness, you know. Yeah, you know, he's known to not be all there all the time. And, you know, he just, you know, messed up. But it was near his prized Corvette. So that would give a certain amount of forgiveness to the illegal act. And
I mean, when it was Donald Trump was that, you know, they discovered and raided and seized government documents, I mean, all the, you know, language that was.
And he was withholding that. He was withholding them. But the interesting thing is Biden is a really interesting person, and I'm going to relate him to Trudeau, our prime minister here in Canada. And that Biden, first of all, he represents all his life before he was president or vice president and president. He represents the state of Delaware. And Delaware comes the closest in the United States being a state that's actually just a corporation. It's not very big. You know, it's not very big. I'm not sure it even has a million people in it. It's essentially a suburb of Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. But the primary corporation going back to the 1700s was DuPont, you know, and it was like DuPont was a corporation that owned a state. You know, now it's all the credit card companies, and all the credit card companies in the United States, or if you want to do business as a credit card company in Delaware, you go in the United States, you go to Delaware because Delaware charges no income tax. They just charge a fee for you having your corporate status. My sense is that if you take technology and you think of the its unifying of corporations and government, Joe Biden may be the most veteran techno-fascist leader we've had in the history of the United States. He's a techno-fascist. And one of the things that they say about techno-fascists is that you're doing everything for the good of the people. You know, you're doing everything for the good of the people because you kind of want to lull them to, you know, you want to give them a soporific because then you can control all their activities and everything else. So my sense is the temptation is there. I mean, we're moving back and forth between this, you know, the physical world and the cloud, the digital world. And you have to be aware that there's ways of misusing this crossover between Cloudlandia and the physical world. And I think techno-fascism is really good. It's got some bite to it, you know. I mean, you talk about Nazis. Say, don't say Nazis, you know, Nazis, you know. They're dead and gone and everything else. And, you know, you're a communist, Soviet communist. Don't say Soviet communist. But hardly anyone really knows that fascism was really the first successful kind of anti-democratic human that really worked. It worked from around for 25 years. It was actually, and both Stalin and Hitler really studied Mussolini because Mussolini had really created something very successful. But after the war, everybody said, well, Nazism is gone. And then after the Cold War, communism is going. What if there was a creep in the closet called fascism and it just came out and it infiltrated all the large corporations and the technology companies and, you know, the university system and, you know, the federal bureaucracies and everything else? There's this fascism, creepy fascism, and they use technology and the impact of technology on people to gain control of the people. Dr. Fauci, for example, was a techno-fascist. You know, he had the makings.
Like, what are philosophical, you know, or ideological boundaries kind of thing? They're going to take on, I guess, the biases of the creators of these kind of things. I was thinking about what, because I've been seeing now everybody, you know, ChatGPT is the new, you know, tulips right now. Everybody is completely crazy about ChatGPT, and that's the big thing. And
the people who are crazy about it are really crazy about it.
Oh yeah, like, I mean, this is like, you know, we've seen, like, a couple of years ago everybody was crazy about Clubhouse, and a couple of years, you know, last year it was NFTs were like crypto. That's all the thing. And now it seems like nobody's really talking about crypto, and except for, you know, what a shady situation a lot of those things got into. But yeah, it's completely like full force ChatGPT and the language building up around it, prompting and, you know, prompt craft and all of the stuff that's the skill that's going to make it work. And I was thinking, you know, what's going on? What does this mean, actually? Like, if we fast forward, like push the accelerator pedal on this, what's going to be the outcome in our world?
Well, I think that there's a strong trait of utopianism in in society. And I think that America didn't have fascism. Fascism, it's never been a part of American language or discussion narrative, fascism. But there was a word, progressivism. And if you go back and look where fascism started, progressivism starts at the same time. And for example, the first fascist president that the United States had was Woodrow Wilson. He lived from 1912 to 1920. And he hated the U.S. Constitution. Okay, hated the Constitution. He was a professor. He was a history and philosophy professor. And then he became governor, I think, of New Jersey. Might have been New Jersey. And then he was nominated and was elected. And he said the Constitution was created by a bunch of 18th century people who were dealing with an agricultural economy. Okay. Sure. And what they wrote and what they stipulated and the structure they put in place, it doesn't work in a mass industrial production system where we have brand new technologies all the time. So he said that we have to take power out of the hands of the elected officials and out of the hands of the voters. And we have to give it to the experts. And these are experts in fields of knowledge that the elected officials can't possibly know and the voters can't possibly know. But this expertise is crucial to the development of the United States as an industrial power in the world. That's a real good description. So what we have to do is we have to get the experts from government to work with the experts of the corporations, and they'll create the road ahead, not only economically, but politically, socially, and culturally for the head. That's fascism, And so there's nothing that happened in the First World War, Second World War, or the Cold War, they got rid of that belief. I think there's just a lot of people who believe that, we should have the experts talking to each other. And if a crisis comes up, we have to have experts. We have to give them dictatorial powers. We gave Dr. Fauci dictatorial powers. Even the president of the United States obeyed him. He says, this is what you have to do now. This is what you do. And so Dr. Fauci, I think, is, he'll be seen in the future as, if things go in a way for the country, he'll be seen as Dr. Evil. He's sort of Dr. Evil. And he's got weird things about him. Somebody interviewed him in his house. Wall to wall, floor to ceiling, is filled with portraits of himself.
Oh, really?
Portraits
wow.
of him. Yeah. Yeah. Drawings and photos and everything. And these are paintings and drawings and sketches and photographs that people have sent, sometimes just of himself, sometimes with other people. And he said, well, I have to show them because it would be impolite to the person if they ever came and visited. They ever came and visited, and they said, well, where's the picture I sent you? So he's just surrounded by pictures of Dr. Fauci looking out at Dr. Fauci. So I don't know if that indicates anything off or anything creepy, but it would for me. I'd feel a bit creeped out by that.
Wow. I get it.
So the big thing is that there's actually two things that counteract techno-fascism. One is entrepreneurs who create new things and people who are workers who do productive work in creating the new practical things that are useful and make life more productive. So I think that I think it's actually creators and producers.
I'm wondering, what is the ramifications of
everybody having access to a, you know, a digital content sweatshop, basically, staffed with infinite high school honor students at your beck and call for free. And that's what ChatGPT really falls into, right? It's this digital content creation sweatshop that we can just like order people to do this. It seems like I'm watching the horse race of these things and it all unfold. Of course, writing books, there's every, you know, all the way now. It's funny how the evolution of new technology, it starts and then it's how to use it and then how to make money with it and how to make money passively. And the new thing is writing ebooks and selling them on Amazon, like getting, you know, ChatGPT to write your book for you. And it just, I don't know, Dan, there's something about the,
I got a couple of things. Do they own the property that they create, or is it automatically the ownership of the medium that uses it? They might get a small fee for it, but if they're the creator, but does the creator actually own what they create? Okay, so that's number one.
Question.
Yeah, number two, does it make anything more productive?
That's what I wonder. That's my point, is that I think we're reaching a point where now we already talked about how much content is created right now. And I just did some update on the thing. So the latest numbers, and I don't have the exact numbers, Dan, but in the 4 million something hours, mid 4 million hours a day are posted on YouTube right now. And so that I did the math. And it would take you 432 years to consume one day's worth of uploads on YouTube. The interesting thing is, collectively, we consume mid 5 million hours of content per day. So there's a shortfall still of new all this content. There's still, we consume at a rate greater than it's
being somebody's consumed. Watching something from yesterday.
Yeah, well, that's true, right? Yeah, like you wonder that. But I wonder.
I mean, if it's 4 million new, you have to multiply that by 365 because it tells you what the total new content for the year is. Yeah, yeah. No wonder I'm after the lifetime extender. No wonder I'm pushing for the lifetime extender.
Yeah. I think, if you look at it on a curve, it would be that the creation of content is going up on a daily basis.
Yeah.
The daily consumption is going up, slightly, but will reach there's a limit to it. There's a limit, a constraint to that. But the actual daily consumption collectively compared to the total available content is going to be going lower and lower and lower. Like you're consuming some increasingly lowering percentage of the available content. Yeah. Because you're right that when you're creating this digital content is adding to the pile, right? So that's getting 436 new years every day is being added to the pile. And you're right. Those 5 million that we're consuming are not all the new stuff. It's not that it's only the new.
Yeah. Yeah. And what I think, I left off the last podcast with my three rules for staying cool and calm, which are everything's made up, nobody's in charge, and life's not fair. Okay? Uh-huh. And I've been testing this on various people, and they're intrigued by it. I can't say that they're immediately transformed by it, but I've not found anyone who's not intrigued by it. Okay. And then each of them generates a discussion. They say, well, when you say everything's made up, what do you mean? Well, everything that is part of the human experience takes place in thoughts and words was made up at some point. So, there was a point when somebody made up the word technology. There was a word when somebody made up the word fascism. There was a word when somebody made up Cloudlandia, you know?
Yeah.
And I said, and I just want you to do, because sometimes it's forgotten, because there's this feeling that there are things that are just real, you know? And I said, well, we make things real, you know, humans make things real. You know, and like I was talking to a fairly radical environmentalist, in the sense that they would be incensed about 80 or 90% of what I believe is actually happening with the climate and everything else. So they would be outraged about that. And I says, well, we can't destroy nature because we created nature. And she said, we created nature. I said, yeah, until somebody said the word nature, there was no nature. When you have to name something before there's any reality to it, you know, and then there's nature, and now people can discuss nature and the thing, because before we made up the word nature, it was just a bunch of stuff. Yeah. And she said, well, that's outlandish. That's outlandish. I said, yeah, but you have to realize that your belief about the environment, you made that up. I said, no, nobody else has the explanation for this in their heads that you have in your head. So you made up your explanation, and that goes for me, too. That goes for me, too.
Yeah.
The only difference is that you think that there's a thing called nature that exists independently of human experience, and I'm saying there isn't. Okay. Yeah. And she says, well, if you took away all the human beings, it would still be there. And I said, no, it wouldn't be, because there'd be no human beings to experience it.
If a tree falls in the forest, right.
Yeah. And she said, and then things would be better. I said, well, better, you know, there would be nobody to experience better, you know, if you took all the human beings away. We're the only ones who can experience better. We're the only ones who can experience bigger. So anyway, and then nobody's in charge. And I said, well, I said, if you think somebody's in charge, spend some time with them and ask them, do they feel like they're in charge? And most of them said, I hope people notice that I'm actually not in charge. You know, it's sort of the only thing that keeps me in charge is the belief that other people see me that way. And, you know, and I'm not saying there's anything wrong with it. There's nothing wrong with everything's made up, and there's nothing wrong with there's nobody in charge, and life's not fair. And I said, there's nothing wrong with life's not fair. And they said, well, you know, it just means that there's all this unfairness. And I said, well, yeah, but have you seen any evidence of it being any other way? I haven't seen any evidence of it not being fair. I mean, you can make it fair for yourself, and you can extend your fairness to other people, but that's made
up. You can also make it unfair for you.
And you're in charge. And you're in charge, you know. So it's an interesting thing that you can take any belief and you can say, well, you know, somebody made up this belief, and there's nobody in charge of keeping the belief going. And probably if you feel it's fair to you, it probably isn't fair to somebody else, your belief.
Right. Yeah. That's all everybody's concerned with, is that it's fair. That's not fair to me.
Yeah.
That's what people are saying when they're saying it's not fair.
Yeah.
When people are arguing for fairness. Yeah.
Yeah. But so anyway, it's really, I think the ChatGPT, there's something special about this particular technological breakthrough, because it really is tapping into an existing knowledge base manipulated by individual creativity.
Yeah, I was thinking about I was overlaying, like, because we're certainly personifying it. So I was starting to think, what would be the Myers-Briggs type of ChatGPT? And as far as, you know, introvert or extrovert, sensing or intuitive, thinking or feeling, judgment or perception. And I think that it would be an ISTJ. It would be an introverted sensing, meaning guided by all of the reality, the world, what's known kind of thing. Thinking, not feeling, and judging, having rules, and, you know, guided by sort of keeping them. And then I was thinking, what would be the Colby? of ChatGPT, if you think, if we're personifying it, what would be, you know, be a 10 fact finder, you know, be high on follow through. But how, yeah. What about the quick start of a ChatGPT of AI?
I think the new applications would be driven by the quick starts.
But you'd have to,
I'll give you an idea. I've got Babs has a birthday coming up on the 23rd of January. Uh-huh. So I said to Gord Vickman, who's my podcast manager, I said, Gord, get our printed biography of Babs the way that we publish it on our website, because she has a bio page on the website. And uh-huh. I said, simply take it and run it through ChatGPT in the style that Donald Trump wrote it. Donald Trump wrote the GPT. And then he did it in like 3 minutes and it came back. And it was great. You know, it was really great. It had considerably altered it from the way it was written, you know, on the podcast. I mean, it had real Trumpish flair to it. And, you know,
it's a tremendous influence.
And it's the other thing was, I said, okay, now I bet there's AI programs out there that can simulate famous people's voices, aren't there? And he says, yeah, I think there are. I says, go find a Trump voice and have Trump read what he wrote.
Yeah.
Okay. And it was really good. It was really good. I mean, it wasn't perfect, but if you played it to somebody, they would immediately got the connection that this is a Trump imitator, if anything. I mean, you would say this is a Trump imitator. And that took about 5 seconds. Well, it took the time it took him to talk it through.
Find it.
You know, and everything. And I was really charmed with it. I was really charmed.
That's something. I mean, you know, I'm starting to see that it's not, this is like a quick start amplifier. You know, it's giving quick start an artificial, you know, dialing up the fact finder, follow through, and implementer of a quick start, because it doesn't have it on its own. The best outcomes are going to come from, you've got to bring the idea to the chat GPT.
Yeah.
Everything is possible. I said to Eben, I had a nice chat with Eben Pagan this week, and I was saying how it feels like this, you know, chat prompting is going to be very soon the new piano lessons, you know, that I think that kids are going to be spending an hour learning, you know, chat AI prompting skills to create things, as opposed to learning.
Yeah, they're going to compose.
Theory and,
they're going to compose things. You know, do you think we can take a minute, because I'm going to run up and get my computer and I'm going to play what we actually came up with?
Let's do it.
I'm just going to do it. I'll be up and down in a minute here, but I'm just.
Okay, no problem.
Okay, bye.
let me tell you about Babs Smith. She's a winner. Babs, along with Dan Sullivan.
Okay. You there? Okay. I'm just going to start it here. I have to move it back to the start. And got the... I'll just play it near the speakers here. Okay.
Okay.
Folks, let me tell you about Babs Smith. She's a winner. Babs, along with Dan Sullivan, founded Strategic Coach, and let me tell you, they built an incredible business together. Now, I know Dan may be the outside face of the company, but let me tell you, Babs is the driving force behind the scenes. She's got an incredible blend of smarts and personal insight that helped make Strategic Coach an incredible organization. It's a great place to work for everyone who's part of it. And trust me, Babs is more than just a successful businesswoman. She's also a leader who genuinely cares about helping her team learn what they're good at. It's called their unique ability, and they use it in their work. And that's what makes Strategic Coach such a special place. It's a self-managing company, and it's a powerful way to run a business. It's a totally different way to succeed in business. You should check it out. So, folks, Babs Smith is a true leader and a winner. And I can tell you firsthand, she knows how to run a successful business.
There.
Wow. I mean, there we go.
Yeah.
I mean, this is, you know, you think what you see. I wonder how far we are away from like the perfection of these things, like that technology. I mean, definitely you can tell that's Donald Trump-ish, but we're not far off from it being perfect. And video representation of Donald. I saw that Bruce Willis had signed a deal to, you know, give his digital, sold his digital right. There's something going on with Bruce Willis that his voice is, you know, going away. He's not going to be able to
act.
But he's got his, he's been, you know, capturing his digital likeness or whatever. So that there'll be movies with Bruce Willis, you know. It's pretty, it's definitely the creators, the people who, imagination is going to be something that is.
Well, and I think that, that, you know, that he will come into its full bloom here, you know.
Right, exactly.
Yeah, because you have to
with capability.
You have to have a sort of productive distractibility, you know, because you're thinking one thing, then you think of something that logically doesn't follow, and you put the two of them together, and there's a humor in that. There's actually, you know, when two things that don't belong together are suddenly put together, there's a humor there because everybody's brains have to adjust in a second, and I think that's there's a big dopamine hit when that happens.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I thought it was pretty good. I mean,
very good.
They put that together in about 5 minutes, you know, start to finish. And, but my, here's my sense, and we talked about this last week, that if you're a generally unproductive, frivolous person, engaging with this technology will amplify and multiply your general uselessness.
Yeah.
And if you're really productive and you're, you know, you're creating new value, I think there'll be a multiplier there too.
Yeah. Yeah. This is, it's so such an endlessly fascinating.
Yeah.
My, you know, thing to explore. Just, it's a great place for your mind to go. Just my thinking about the ramifications of this. Where does this head? Like, what if we push the accelerator pedal here? And where are we going to land? Like, right now, the easy, low-hanging fruit is you can see that we're literally going to be coming up on a... We're going to have a surge of, I think, in a lot of ways, mediocre digital content created, you know, especially in books and e-books.
Just based on my wants, because I myself do not want to involve myself with this technology.
Right.
You know, like I expressed this to Gord, and Gord had it with me in 5 minutes. Well, that's my general approach to all technology. I take a interested, enthusiastic, skillful human. And I put him in between. And I can't see myself budging off my standard approach to any technology.
I hear you. I get it. Exactly.
You know what? I'm going to spend a whole day doing this? No, I'm not going to spend
right.
Yeah, I'm going to read British detective stories. That's what I'm going to be doing. Or creating a new exercise for the program, or
right.
Finish creating a new quarterly book. So this doesn't alter my behavior in the least, but it gives me an idea for encouraging people who are naturally drawn in this direction to get really good at this, so that I can give them suggestions on things and they can come back with a finished product in a matter of minutes rather than in the matter of a week or a month.
Yeah, I like this. Like, that's the way I'm saying it. I'm thinking about this executive producer kind of role. My role in this is I just want to come up with once we know what it's capable of, then that's where we can let the creativity come of you having the idea that, what if we did Donald Trump reading an intro of Babs? That would be great. But now, the time it took you to think that, that's the imagine if you applied yourself formula.
That was just a few seconds,
Yeah. You imagine that would be something interesting. Okay, well, if that's true, what needs to, we need to find the thing. And then you applied, hey, Gord, do this yourself, your sphere, Gord's in your sphere.
Yeah.
And you just established, you just used your leadership.
Yeah.
I think that's the way we're heading here. I can't see myself, prompting, hand feeding in prompts to and playing with and editing the stuff. You think of, because you got to understand the limitations too. Like, none of your quarterly books could be written by an AI. That's not.
No.
Even the thought for what the book is about. That's not, I was thinking about your thinking, but there's no AI that could have written that book, with any prompting. But what you've set up in a way is your team, and the way we do the 90-minute books is really the way of, you're the actual intelligence that is being prompted to put out the content orally, that digitizing it through speaking it, and that becomes the thing. It's maximizing your output.
See, what I'm thinking, because I've been reading these articles and I started this book by this Italian, and I think there's a considerable number of people in the world who find other people's unpredictable freedom very threatening to them. And that's what I think techno-fascism is. It's to get a hold on the general population in such a way that any new thought that might threaten the status quo of the corporate or the government establishment would be made illegal, And it could be technologically prevented. Prevented. You cannot talk that. And so my feeling is that the great fear is that nobody's out of the blue, like Mr. Beast. Mr. Beast is a nobody out of the blue, suddenly creates an entirely new entertainment form, and then takes that entertainment form knowledge and moves it right into the commercial world with Mr. Beastburger and everything. And corporate executives dread that type of person coming along that might totally make what they're doing obsolete, obsolete. And my feeling is that there's a great fear. And I was thinking, I had a conversation with Peter Diamandis about this with Google. And he says, well, they're the ones, he says, they've been on top of AI. And I said, I said to him, they haven't mastered probably in terms of what they want to do, but there may be, 18-year-olds out there, 19-year-olds now, who are creating new things that Google will not be, because they have 30 or 40 years under their belt, that they're too bureaucratic to be able to respond to some new things that are happening in the marketplace. Mm-hmm. And I said, you know, before there was Google, before there was Microsoft, before there was Apple, the 800-pound gorilla in the electronics world, computer world, was IBM. Who even talks about IBM anymore? I mean, right. Who even brings up the topic? Well, IBM was the gargantuan on the planet. It was the King Kong of computerization in the 70s, and nobody even talks about it. I says, don't you think there will be some very inventive, enthusiastic young person or groups of young people or networks of young people who are innovators now who will create an entirely new form out of ChatGPT and the other, other sort of relevant AI programs that would just make Google something that people don't even talk about. You know, I'm not saying it disappeared. Microsoft hasn't disappeared. It's just that IBM hasn't disappeared. They're a big company and, you know, they're a prosperous company, but nobody ever talks about them as being relevant.
Well, I think just like I think that the ChatGPT, the AI, all of that, like that kind of interface with AI, and apparently the new, GPT-4 is 500 times more, access to 500 times more knowledgeable than current one. It's just a ring fence, portion of the top 20% kind of thing of the known stuff.
Yeah.
And I think that just like the iPhone lent itself to the iOS thing, lent itself to a platform that created apps, that I think it's going to be all the overlays on top of that AI access. I mentioned that we watched that movie, Her, again, with Joaquin Phoenix, and how his, you have a relationship with his operating system. So 10 years later, that movie is like, that's where we are right now. And he worked at a company called heartfeltletters.com. And it was him, writing, they would write letters to, on your behalf. And that's, I think, what there's an opportunity for me to overlay that on ChatGPT to say, write a heartfelt letter for my grandmother, or and talk about this and this, or write a love letter, that those kind of niche, siphoning off doorways into the back end of the AI. It's almost like the way scientists have mapped the brain now to say, this is the portion for sound and this is the portion for that does sight, all of that. Almost like being able to tap into AI for a specific purpose, Yeah,
and it was really interesting. Hamish McDonald, my cartoonist, just sent me a little AI program. It was called U.com. Very rudimentary, not on the level of ChatGPT. Because I was thinking about Gutenberg, and we talked about Gutenberg on the last podcast. And so I just said, show me all the articles, and this is at the same level of Google. I said, show me all the articles that are on the topic of Gutenberg's social impact, and all of a sudden there are about 20 different articles. Okay.
Wow.
And then I said, write me a 500-word essay, the five most important impacts of Gutenberg on modern life. And, it was about 20 seconds, came back, well written, perfectly spelled, good sentence structure. And it was really useful. It got my thinking.
With a Sherpa? Were you doing this yourself or with Sherpa?
No, this wasn't any more difficult. This wasn't any more difficult than interacting with Google.
Yeah, that's what I mean. So you were doing the driving.
Yeah, I was doing the driving and, you know, I was doing the design of the search and, you know, design of the project. And but I do that already with humans, with impact filters and fast filters and, you know, and everything like that. But I think that knowing what you want is a big important skill here. Being able to communicate crystal clear when you're talking to someone who's a who, that you can give them crystal clear exactly what you want. And I haven't seen any technology that improves that skill.
Right. I think you can have, I think in a lot of ways, that's what you're trying to do or enabling people. That's what thinking, that's what the tools are, the thinking.
Thinking about your thinking.
Yeah, thinking about your thinking is, that's really what it comes down to.
Yeah.
It's the prompts that create the prompts, you know? That's really...
I was on a podcast on Friday. I don't know if you've ever come across a coach client by the name of Tony D'Angelo.
The name sounds familiar.
Yeah, and he's got a company that works with universities and colleges. And I'm not entirely sure of the, you know, the exact service or product that's being created. But he's, you know, he's been in coach about 10 years. And he's got a new podcast called Intellectual Capitalist. Okay. Mm-hmm. And this is the launch. And I was the launch. I was the launch guest for the first one.
I love that name. And, Intellectual Capitalist. Yeah.
Yeah. And he's, no, I'm sorry, I'm mistaking, because I had something in the morning and it was with Shannon Waller. So we were doing our podcast series, which is called Inside Strategic Coach. And we usually do three. And she had a question. She says, Dan, you put an enormous emphasis on entrepreneurs getting in touch with their past and actually keep extracting value from their past so they can create value in their future. And she said, so why do you think the past is so important? And I said, why do I think my past is so important? And she says, yeah, you can start off there. And I said, because it's my property. Nobody else has the foggiest idea what it is.
Right.
So it's complete uniqueness. It's just unlimited uniqueness back there, because nobody else has any of my experiences. Nobody has any of my thinking about my experiences. You know, and the thinking about your thinking book is a good example of that, because I started off with something really important that happened to me when I was 6 years old, you know, which framed my life, you know, and, you know, I wasn't just a little, you know, a little object getting pushed around by adults.
Right. Your mom giving you instruction. You do what you, reading.
Yeah. Reading, important than going to school.
Points you in the right direction. That's right.
Ice cream. Eating ice cream was more important than going to school.
Can you imagine though, Dan, just think about the vector, you know, that at 6 years old, she nudged you that 3 degrees towards reading as the most important thing, and you play that out over the next 72 years, and here's where we are. I mean, that's a completely different place.
Yeah, and it seems like a consistent life for me, you know. I mean, it's kind of like, it's been like a one project life. You know, and anyway, but it's really interesting, because talking about this, you know, I have my 5 panelists who are going to be there. I have Mike Koenig is going to be one of the panelists, and Lior Weinstein. Met Lior, have you met?
I have.
Probably.
Yeah.
And then it'll be Lee Richter and Evan Ryan, who is new to Free Zone, and he's the youngest. And so he's noteworthy for me because I'm 50 years older than he is. That's my first entrepreneur that I've got 50 years on. Okay. But he's actually been in the practice of working with AI for clients for about 4 years. So he's got a lot of practical experience. And then Stephen Poulter, who's using a lot of chat GPT fact-finding in that for his medical practice. Yeah. So, and I just said, just tell everybody how you're putting it to practical use in your business and how you see this as changing your game and how you see that you can get bigger and better results by using this and where it fits into your general game plan of what you're trying to achieve and how it introduces greater productivity, you know, just to tell everybody what it is.
That's great.
Yeah. And then we'll have everybody brainstorm and then we'll do the triple play. We'll do the triple, everybody will do the triple play, you know. Okay. These are three things and then connect. Why is this important? Why is this important? Why is this? And then we'll have a general, you know, Q&A, general discussion with it. So I think it'll thing. But you got to talk your way into, you got to talk and think your way into something like this, you know.
That's true.
There's always going to be people who will do the technology for you.
Yeah, anything. Well, it's that, you know, that is the big distinction of challenges and technical challenges. That whole thing, once somebody figured out how to do something, it's immediately become a technical challenge, which is, you know, who eligible? There's like, who knows how already.
Yeah. Yeah.
So much excitement, well, Dan. What's coming?
But it's neat witnessing it.
Yeah.
You know, it's, you know, one of the things when I was growing up, I would ask people, what was seeing an airplane like? And I was talking to people who had been flying around the turn of the, you know, right around 1900. And, you know, in the first 10 years, they were children. And that's when there were cases where somebody flying in an airplane could be seen. And they said it transformed you. When you could see it and when you saw it, you know, and and you know, it was illegal what Orville and Wilbur Wright did. You know, it's illegal, did you?
Right. Oh, right. Illegal.
They didn't have pilot's licenses.
That's right. They were flying without a license, you know.
Well, not only that, but they didn't.
You're
not
allowed to do that at the beach.
They didn't even, they had no flight time, you know, they had no.
Yeah.
Everything's made up.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Oh, this is so great, Dan. Well, these conversations, I just find them so, they stimulate my thinking.
Well, you know, we created the dinner table with Welcome to Cloudlandia, and then we got a big whopping piece of new fresh meat on the
absolutely we do it's
on the table.
Finally,
you know,
finally everybody caught up with us.
Anyway, I'll be on next week if you're okay.
For sure.
And then we're going to New Orleans for our first meeting with Richard Rossi's Da Vinci 50 group. So
okay, great.
And then we'll be in Palm Beach the first week of, and we're going to spend some days free in Palm Beach instead of spending them free in Arizona this year. We're going to spend them.
Okay, good. We'll connect offline.
I'll give you the schedule. And
I'm going to early too.
And then I'll send you a fast filter for your presentation. Mm-hmm. And I think Mr. Beast would be a wonderful topic. Even today, people don't know who he is, you know, in coach.
No, exactly. I think that there's a couple of others that are.
And you can put together some videos and everything. And then some news, like he was offered $1 billion.
Yes, of course.
To take him out of the game, actually. That's what it was. Yeah. It was $1 billion to take him out of the game.
Yes, I love it.
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay.
That's great. Have a great week, Dan.
Okay. Thanks. Bye.